All right, good morning. Welcome to Bio 231. And it's Wednesday, the last class for the week, and it's March 21st. And let's see, on the projectors are working good. On the right-hand side, we've got the syllabus. Let's just take a look at the schedule real quick. Okay, there's a lab schedule. Here's the schedule for lectures. And March 21st, we're going to start nervous system today. I got a couple comments left for endocrine system, so I'm going to finish up endocrine, chapter 17, and then start talking about nervous system, just some basic introductory material. That's chapter 12. And then when we finish with chapter 12, that will be the last bit of material for the next lecture exam. But we don't have a lecture exam next week. Okay, we're going to have some more lectures on nervous system stuff, like central nervous system and peripheral nervous system. But we do have practicums that week, so that's why we don't have a lecture exam. So we're going to postpone the lecture exam until after spring break, because that's the week after next week, for instructors, spring break for instructors. But since we don't come to school, you guys don't have to come to school either. Okay, but you still have to study a little bit every day. That's what makes the class easy, if you do that. All right, doesn't make it harder, it makes it a lot easier. All right, then right when we come back from spring break, we're going to have lecture exam number 3, but it's not on the Monday, it's on the Wednesday. So we're going to flip from Monday test to Wednesday test for exam 3 and 4. So April 11th will be exam number 3. It sounds like it's really far away, but, you know, it's actually coming pretty quick. But you guys do have to study during spring break. Okay, any questions over endocrine system so far? What I talked about. In terms of physiology, this is probably the most complicated topic that we've talked about so far, was endocrine control. And I do want to go over one last thing with the pituitary gland. Remember, how many parts to the pituitary are there? Two main parts. There's an anterior and a posterior. They secrete different hormones and they're controlled differently. They're both controlled by the hypothalamus. So the hypothalamus is considered part of the central nervous system as well as an endocrine gland. But the hypothalamus controls the anterior pituitary by secreting releasing factors or releasing hormones that go from the hypothalamus into the anterior pituitary via the hypophyseal portal system. And hypophysis is just another name for pituitary. So the anterior pituitary is helped regulated by this special circulatory system called the hypophyseal portal system. The posterior pituitary, on the other hand, is really not glandular tissue. It's part of the central nervous system. It's neuronal tissue. And here are some cell bodies of neurons that send their axons down through the infundibulum into the posterior pituitary. And when electrical activity reaches the ends of those neurons, they then directly release hormones. So for the posterior pituitary, there are no releasing factors or releasing hormones from the hypothalamus. It's just direct electrical connection to the hypothalamus. And can anybody remember the two hormones released from the posterior pituitary? There are two. There's only two. There's ADH, antidiuretic hormone, which helps you conserve water in your body. It's an antidiuretic. And then oxytocin, which is a smooth muscle stimulant. It causes smooth muscle to contract. What would be two reasons why a smooth muscle should contract? Okay, the heart is cardiac muscle, a little bit different than smooth. Digestion. Yeah, there's a lot of smooth muscle in the digestive tract, but I don't know of any good correlation with the hormone oxytocin. Oxytocin would be the hormone from the posterior pituitary that's going to cause contraction of smooth muscle, and I'll have to give you a hint, in terms of the reproductive system. So parturition, yeah, contraction of the uterus during parturition, all right, and also contraction of smooth muscle around the glandular tissue of the breast for the milk letdown reflex when an infant is nursing, okay? Those are two important reasons for oxytocin, and there's other important reasons. All right, so that's the hypothalamus and pituitary. Then the pituitary then controls other kinds of organs, like a thyroid gland is controlled by thyroid-stimulating hormone. Ovaries and testes are controlled by follicle-stimulating hormone and luteinizing hormone. ACTH, what is ACTH control? What other organ? It's in the name, but I didn't say the name. I abbreviated. Adrenal corticotropic hormone, it means the adrenal cortex. Okay? And prolactin, okay, lactin is lactose is a sugar that we find in milk. All right, so this goes to the breast, and growth hormone pretty much goes all over the body, pretty much all muscles and bones, for instance, and it stimulates growth. All right, so that's what we talked about last time. What do we want to talk about this time? We're going to move to adrenal cortex. All right, so let me find some pictures of adrenal cortex. I think we talked about the thyroid gland already. Okay, here's the kidney. Kidneys are posterior to the abdominal cavity, and on top of the, oh, here they are. Right here are the kidneys in the trunk, and the adrenal glands are right on top. The adrenal glands have an inner division that we call the medulla, and an outer division that we call the, what do we call the superficial part of any organ? Whether it's bone or kidney or adrenal gland, it's the cortex is the outer superficial part. The deep part is the medulla. And if we look at a cross-section, the histology of a cross-section across the adrenal gland, we can see that it has many layers. So this is the cortex, and here is the medulla. Medulla, we said, secreted norepinephrine, which is, it helps the sympathetic nervous system do its job. But these layers right here are responsible for secreting cortisol, which is a glucocorticoid, and aldosterone, which is a mineralocorticoid. All right, so mineralocorticoids, aldosterone, it helps maintain blood pressure because it helps you maintain sodium, high levels of sodium inside your body. So as you increase sodium inside your body, that will help you maintain water, and that will increase your blood pressure when that happens. So, for instance, if you lose a lot of water from your body, your blood volume will decrease. What will happen to your blood pressure if your blood volume decreases? Okay? Think of your car tire or your bicycle tire. If you put air in your tire, what happens to the pressure inside the tire? It goes up. Same thing with your blood volume. If you increase blood volume, your blood pressure is going to go up. So if somebody has high blood pressure, way too high blood pressure, what would be one way to reduce their blood pressure very nicely? Okay, yeah, you could cut them and drain some water, drain some blood out of them. That would reduce their blood pressure. But there's a safer method. They could take a diuretic, and they can then just pee water out of their body. Not blood, but water. They would lose water, and that's going to reduce their blood pressure. That's always the first line for treatment of hypertension, is to take a diuretic and then to see what happens. Okay. All right, so then there's glucocorticoids. Cortisol is the main type. It helps deal with stressful situations. So it helps mobilize glucose. It helps increase blood glucose concentration in your body by adjusting metabolism of fatty acids and proteins and even sugar stores inside your body. All right, these all come from the adrenal cortex. And there's one more that's not on your list right here that I think, oh yeah, we did talk about it last time. What was the last hormone? I see it right here on the slide. Androgens. Androgens is just a class of compounds which testosterone belongs to, and testosterone is a male sex steroid. All right, so even females do have some androgens in their body from the adrenal cortex right here. And what did we say? What's the function of androgens in the female? Aggression, like maternal aggression, and sex drive as well. Okay. All right, so that's the adrenal cortex. Pineal gland. Whoa, let's see if I can find the pineal gland. Part of the brain. So let's go way back up to a nice brain slide. So here's the pituitary to give you an orientation. Here's the hypothalamus. And the pituitary is way in the posterior part of the brain. And kind of shaped like a little pine cone. It secretes a hormone called melatonin that helps regulate circadian rhythms, right? So these are rhythms in your body that have to do with day and night cycles. And some people are morning people, some are late morning or afternoon people, okay? and we probably think that this pineal gland helps regulate this activity. The other thing that we think that it does is as we get older, it atrophies. It turns into a bone. We call that ossification, when something turns into bone, and it kind of loses its function, and it starts to lose function right at puberty. So we actually think that this organ right here starts to atrophy, and it controls the onset of puberty. So when it's active, somebody is in an adolescent stage, and when it goes away, that de-represses the development system, and then somebody reaches adulthood. So it could also be involved with regulating reproductive cycles and maybe reproductive drive. These are all things that people are still trying to decide. And this pineal gland in some animals is very superficial in the brain, really close to the skull. And the part of the skull in some animals is very, very thin, so a lot of light can enter the brain, and it affects the pineal gland. For instance, frogs and birds and things like that. So frogs and birds are very susceptible to circadian rhythms. Like, when do birds breed? At least in this part of the world. In the wintertime? Or end of summer? Beginning of summer? No, springtime, right? So that's the safest time. I know that's what you were saying all along. Thank you for reminding me. Okay, so the pineal gland certainly is involved with circadian rhythms and breeding cycles. We just don't know so much about people, but it's probably not very particular to light cycles, except for information that you get from the eyes are connected to the pineal gland. Okay, the pancreas. Where the heck is the pancreas at? It's below the stomach. It's in the abdominal cavity. So here's the pancreas. We don't see the stomach, but it will be about in this location right here, right underneath the diaphragm. And it contains endocrine and exocrine cells. Endocrine means that it's secreting a product into the blood, but an exocrine gland secretes something into a duct that carries it to where it's going to have its action. Okay, the exocrine cells come from little circular structures that we call acinar structures. Okay, so here are the little circular structures, right? These secrete the precursors to digestive enzymes. That's the exocrine part. And then those digestive enzymes don't stay in the pancreas. They're put into a duct. Why aren't those digestive enzymes in the pancreas, released into the pancreas? Because what does a digestive enzyme do? It digests something. So if those digestive enzymes are activated and released into the pancreas, then the pancreas is going to be digested. And unfortunately, that does happen under some circumstances, like pancreatic cancer and pancreatitis. They're very dangerous diseases, okay? Because that whole pancreas could dissolve away. So those digestive enzymes go into a duct, which then carry them to the digestive system where they act inside the digestive system safely. All right, outside these circular structures, we have little islands. We call these islets of Langerhans, and there are a couple different kinds of cells. There's alpha and beta cells. The beta cells monitor blood glucose, and when your blood glucose level increases, right, these cells release insulin. So these cells release insulin when your blood glucose increases. What's the effect going to be on blood glucose when insulin is released by the beta cells? All right, so the stimulus is a high level of glucose. When insulin is released, then blood glucose comes back down to a normal level because insulin allows all cells in your body to take up glucose from the blood. And when a cell takes glucose from the blood, then the blood concentration goes down. Okay. But just like the triceps and biceps are antagonistic muscles, it's important to have antagonistic control over blood glucose. So if there's a hormone that decreases blood glucose, it's very important to have a hormone that increases blood glucose. So when your blood glucose starts to drop, when you're in a fasted state, like in the morning when you first get up, you haven't eaten anything in a long time, your blood glucose is going to have a tendency to decrease, but the pancreas can measure that decrease in glucose, and it's going to release another hormone, a different hormone that has an opposite action to insulin, and that is glucagon. Glucagon will then increase blood glucose back to where it should be so that you have proper levels of glucose in your body at all times. unless somebody has diabetes. Then they have that inability to control their blood glucose levels, maybe because insulin isn't being produced, or maybe the cells that have a receptor for insulin aren't working properly, or the receptors aren't functioning properly. So there can be different reasons. But glucose regulation comes from the pancreas via these two hormones, glucagon and insulin. And what's the functional relationship between glucagon and insulin? If you're going to just tell me one word that describes the relationship between insulin and glucagon, you could say they are what? Synergistic? They're antagonistic to each other. Okay? And tell me that you appreciate that antagonism is a good thing. Give me two mechanisms that you use all the time that are antagonistic to each other. Oh yeah, in terms of anatomy, flexion and extension for precise control of your body. Gas and brake pedal before you even took an anatomy class, right? All right, so they're very important. Thymus gland, located in the mediastinum, and it's an important immune organ because there are certain kinds of lymphocytes. You had to actually tell me that you could identify a lymphocyte on a practicum at one time. It was kind of a white blood cell, so it's part of your immune response. A lymphocyte is a kind of cell that has very little cytoplasm, has one big round nucleus, right? Maybe that's conjuring up an image from your memory. That's a lymphocyte. It helps fight infections. There are different kinds of lymphocytes. So here's a T lymphocyte, right? So when a lymphocyte goes to the thymus gland to mature to help fight infection, it becomes a T lymphocyte. It becomes activated, or it becomes what we call competent to fight infection. And a T lymphocyte is a special kind of cell that when it bumps into a foreign cell, if you're infected with a bacteria or a virus or a fungus or some other kind of cell, if a T lymphocyte bumps into it, then it can kill it on contact. So it's a contact killer. So there's a lot of T's in contact, and that's why they call it a T lymphocyte. But I think they call it a T lymphocyte because what gland does it become competent in? The thymus gland, right? All right, there are other kinds of lymphocytes that produce antibodies, and those lymphocytes don't need to touch the infecting particle, okay, but the T lymphocyte actually has to bump into it to lyse it. It's a contact killer. Gonads, all right, give me some examples of gonads. Don't say your little brother, okay. Ovaries and testes, right, the primary reproductive or sex organs in our body. They produce gametes, and gametes could either be their sex cells, that could be a sperm or an egg, depending on the gender. Okay, and so the gonads in the male, interstitial cells of the testes secrete androgens. Let me see if I can pull up some testes. Something's happening to my microphone. I don't see a good slide, all right, but we're going to talk a lot about the reproductive system for the last week of the class. Okay, but in the male, interstitial cells secrete androgens, all right, and the testes also secretes testosterone that promotes the formation of sperm. That process is what we call spermatogenesis, but testosterone has effects all over the male body. It maintains secondary sex characteristics. All right, so besides spermatogenesis right inside the testes, it helps the promotion, helps the growth of bigger bones, bigger, stronger muscles, coarser skin, coarser hair, and more hair all over the body. All right, females, the reproductive organ will be the ovaries, and it secretes two steroids, estrogen and progesterone. Estrogen maintains secondary sex characteristics in females, right? And progesterone helps the uterus in preparation for pregnancy, and so does estrogen to some degree, right? But if you want to just have some bullet points for these two hormones, this is a good place to start. So estrogen is the female counterpart to male testosterone, and the male does not have an analog or a counterpart to progesterone. And that's because progesterone is primarily important for maintaining pregnancy. What do we call pregnancy? Gestation is another word for pregnancy. So progesterone really was named progestational hormone, which is just way too long of a word. Progestational hormone has been abbreviated to progesterone, and since males don't go through gestation, then there's absolutely no reason to have any kind of hormone that will maintain gestation in a male, right? So males don't have anything like progesterone, but they have something like estrogen. What's the male hormone that would be similar to estrogen? Is going to be testosterone, right? All right, so that's the endocrine chapter. Right here, any questions on endocrine system?
Yeah.
Yes. They have some only in the sense that it's part of a metabolic pathway to make testosterone, but basically not very much in the way of estrogen under normal circumstances. But any kind of lipid in your body, any kind of fat, and of course cholesterol is a building block for estrogen, any kind of lipid or cholesterol in your body will have some estrogenic properties. Okay. And so, literally, we don't have much estrogen. Males don't have much estrogen, but we have other compounds that can produce some estrogen-like activity in our bodies. So, it's not just a simple yes or no. Okay. All right, so let's put this chapter away. And we're going to move on to nervous system. So get your notes out for nervous system. Here we have it right here, and I think I'm ready to go. I think I have it right here. Okay, I want to start with this flow diagram first. Nervous system divisions. So let me see if I can move it over. And then over here, I want to show you some basic anatomy. So nervous system divisions. We can take the whole nervous system in your body and break it down into two divisions. Two main divisions. Central nervous system, and the second one will be peripheral nervous system. And the central nervous system is just composed of the brain and spinal cord. Maybe we've talked about this already in that first chapter. So here is the brain that's enclosed by the cranial bones. And then here we have the spinal cord, that central nervous system, down to about right here. And the spinal cord is protected, is armored by bones as well. What kind of bones protect the spinal cord? The vertebrae, right? The vertebral column protects the spinal cord just like all the cranial bones protect the brain right here. So it's a nicely protected, armored cavity. And then some tissue leaves the brain, some leaves the spinal cord, and when it leaves the brain and spinal cord, it becomes part of the peripheral nervous system. So everything outside the brain and spinal cord then is what we call the peripheral nervous system. So the brain and spinal cord kind of looks like it's in a beige color to me, maybe green. Okay? I don't know what color it looks like to you. Does beige look green to you? No, not at all. Okay. Well, what color does this brain look like to you right here? Peach. Oh, that's not like beige or green at all. Okay, peach is a fruit, so I have no idea what kind of color that is. All right, so that's central nervous system right here. And then in the gold color, that signifies the what? Peripheral nervous system, not part of the brain or spinal cord. And typically these are what we call nerves. Okay. All right, so the peripheral nervous system, we're going to break down in a couple more divisions. Central nervous system, these two. But for peripheral nervous system, okay, the two divisions will be sensory or motor. And they can't be both at the same time. It's going to be one or the other. Another name for sensory, or what the heck is sensory? A sensory nerve is something that will take information from the outside of your body and bring it to the inside and will actually deliver it to the central nervous system. So the direction is from periphery to your central nervous system. That is sensory. Right, and another name for sensory is afferent, even though you might want to pronounce it afferent, right? But in lecture and lab, I'll say afferent so that you can really see how to spell it. It starts with an A. So it goes from a sensory organ to the central nervous system, and information can only flow in one direction through a neuron. Can't flow both ways. Can only flow in one direction. All right, the other division is the motor division. And motor division will take signals from the CNS, which is the brain and spinal cord, out to the periphery. All right, so that's a motor. It's leaving the central nervous system, going the opposite way compared to sensory. All right, another name for motor is efferent. And you could say efferent if you wanted to. That's a proper pronunciation. But I'm always going to say efferent so that you can tell in lecture and lab what I'm speaking about. All right, so don't forget, efferent is CNS to periphery direction, but afferent is from the periphery into the central nervous system. These are the two major divisions. All right, let's break the motor division down into two more divisions. We have somatic and autonomic. And let's talk about somatic first. Another way of thinking about somatic is that it's part of your voluntary nervous system. That means you have voluntary control of what kind of signals are being passed around in your body. And so what part of your body do you have voluntary control of? I think we've talked about that already. And that is, how about cardiac muscle? Do you have voluntary control of cardiac muscle? No. You can't stop your heart if you wanted to. What about glands? Salivary glands. Ooh, you can't control those. What about when we talked about heart? All right, smooth muscle. Can you control your digestive processes? You get a cramp in your stomach, can you cause that to increase or decrease? You cannot. All right. Or if you have uterine contractions, can you control that? You cannot. They're controlled by the autonomic nervous system. Somatic just means that it's going to go to skeletal muscle. So skeletal muscle is the effector organ of the somatic motor nervous system, and it's under voluntary control. Another way to think of somatic is that it's going to a superficial part of your body. For instance, like an arm or a leg, that's a superficial part as opposed to a deeper part that is a body cavity. So you have organs in body cavities, but that's not really part of your somatic body. Right? Somatic means to the surface, more for bones and skeletal muscle. Autonomic, on the other hand, goes to organs that you don't control, like cardiac muscle, smooth muscle, and glands. You could actually write that in on this slide if you wanted to. It was too complicated for me to do that, but you could just jot it in. All right, and that's what sometimes we call that the visceral system, because it's going to deeper parts of your body, like your heart and stomach and reproductive organs. Right, that are in body cavities, which is different than somatic. Somatic is on the surface. All right, then furthermore, this autonomic nervous system is controlling things that you voluntarily can't control. So visceral means also involuntary. Right, there are two divisions of your autonomic nervous system, and they are the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system. For instance, they will control your heart, smooth muscle, and glands. And there are two divisions right here, okay, in terms of the analogy of your car. Guess why there are two divisions of your autonomic nervous system in terms of your automobile, in terms of your car, or motorcycle, or bicycle, hopefully. I have my fingers crossed. Because why? Because you have an accelerator and a brake pedal in these vehicles, right? Same thing with these two nervous systems. One can be excitatory and the other can be inhibitory. So on the heart, for instance, if you know which one is excitatory, let's just say, and this is the case, that the sympathetic nervous system is excitatory on the heart, now you know what the function of the parasympathetic nervous system is on the heart. What will it be? If sympathetic is excitatory, the parasympathetic will be inhibitory, all right? And these two things work in opposition with each other to produce precise control and balance over your heart. Okay, so that's why there are two, for antagonistic reasons, right? And so most organs receive dual innervation, both sympathetic and parasympathetic, so that they can be precisely controlled. All right, so when we talk about the nervous system, you probably want to have this flow diagram someplace handy to look at, right? Because everything that you'll learn will fit into this diagram to help organize your thoughts. And your book has this diagram in a little bit different form. Okay, here I see the structures of the peripheral and central nervous system. All right, and in your book, this is the diagram. All right, a little bit more complicated, right? the flow diagram I gave you is a little bit simpler, but you can relate this nice simple one that I have to this more complicated one sometime if you wish. But this will work for you in the class very, very nicely. All right, so what about the nervous system? What the heck is the important function of the nervous system? Okay. It's the master control and communication center of the body. All right, so its chief functional divisions, we said, well, there's sensory input, right? There's motor output, and then there's something that's in between that makes sense of the sensory input. All right, so we have afferent neurons that bring information into the central nervous system. Once the information is inside the central nervous system, okay, then all that information is added together so that your mind can make sense of it. The mind makes a decision, or the brain makes a decision, or even the spinal cord can make a decision on what to do, and then it sends that decision out through the motor pathway to an effector organ, right, to protect your body. So, for instance, let's look at this slide over here. I see three different neurons right here. I see a sensory neuron that is bringing information where? Here's the arrow. Into the brain and spinal cord. That's a central nervous system. So that is a definition of a sensory neuron, brings information into the CNS and spinal cord. And in this particular case, what's the stimulus? I see a margarita right there. Okay, picked up by the eye. All right, and that information goes in via this afferent neuron. Now here's the second neuron, neurons that make up the brain and spinal cord. Okay, it's going to say, oh, I see some salt around the edge of the glass, and the glass shape is kind of fancy, right? Oh, and I also smell some tequila, all right? And it goes, that is a margarita. So the brain takes all of that information, adds it together. Maybe you tasted some of the salt on the rim of the glass, so you have some taste sensation that adds to your impression of what that object is. And so the decision then is, what's the decision the brain makes? Oh, I got to put that off for later. Okay, can't have a sip right now because we're in anatomy lecture. But if you weren't in anatomy lecture and you had a mouse, you could move the cursor, but I can't move the cursor anymore. Oh, I'm stuck. Is that terrible or what? I'm going to have to go to the mouse over here. I'll charge this up. Okay, so your brain and spinal cord add all that information up. That's what we call integration, makes a decision, says, not appropriate time, all right? And then this right here is what we call an association or integration neuron, because it's completely found within the central nervous system. I don't see any part of it in the peripheral nervous system. It's all within the brain and spinal cord. And then it sends signals out to this particular skeletal muscle right here, and it causes the skeletal muscles or various skeletal muscles to contract, right, to pick this glass of water up or this margarita or whatever for you to take a drink. So here's information leaving the CNS. What do we call a neuron that's taking information away from the CNS to effector organs in the periphery? That is a motor neuron. What's another name for motor? That would be efferent, right? So efferent, and you could draw that on if you have these slides or draw it in your book. So here's an efferent motor neuron. Here's an afferent sensory neuron. And afferent and sensory are pretty much the same. All right, now for motor, according to this diagram over here, let me click on this slide. I can move this up. In terms of motor, oh, here's the cursor. Here's sensory. Here's motor. How many divisions do you have in the motor nervous system? You got two. You got somatic and you have autonomic. Which one do we see over here on the slide? Is it somatic or is it autonomic? And why? It's somatic. I like somatic, but I got to know why. I'm dying to know why. Why is that? Why do we say somatic and not autonomic? Because it's going to a skeletal muscle. It's going to a voluntary muscle, right? Not deep inside of a body cavity, but more on the surface of your body. So this is a part of the somatic motor pathway to this particular skeletal muscle right here. And probably you could tell me what skeletal muscle that is. Which one does that look like to you? probably looks like biceps. It's a little bit too long to be a brachialis, but if you were thinking brachialis, that's not too bad. Okay. Let's look at some more text slides over here. All right, so don't forget, effector organs for the autonomic nervous system are smooth muscle, cardiac muscle, and glands. Right? The effector for somatic nervous system is skeletal muscle. So what is the only thing that you have under voluntary control in your whole body? You only have control of one thing, and what is that? Skeletal muscle. Everything else is taken care of automatically. Or you could say autonomically. Information processing, sensory or afferent. Input travels from a point of somatic reception on the surface of your body, like this eyeball right here, or maybe tactile receptors on your fingertips, right? From a point of somatic reception to a point of visceral reception, maybe some receptors deep inside your body, to the central nervous system is afferent. Integration is done within the central nervous system. Sometimes we call those integration neurons or association neurons. Right, and then that area makes a decision on what to do with that information, right, and sends the information out motor neurons, right, so they become motor signals that leave the central nervous system that go out into the peripheral nervous system. And then the two divisions are the somatic versus visceral or autonomic. All right, let's talk about some nervous tissue. We talked about nervous tissue a little bit in the second or third chapter, and there are two kinds of cells that make up nervous tissue. As a matter of fact, let's step back just a second. How many major kinds of tissues do you have in your body? You got four. Yeah, what are they? Connective is one. Connective is one. Nervous is one. Epithelium is one. And I'm exercising. Muscle is the third kind. Okay? So nervous tissue is a kind of tissue all by itself, major tissue, and it's composed of two different kinds of cells. It's composed of neurons and support cells. So let's talk about neurons first. Neurons conduct and send electrical information. Support cells don't do that. And a neuron has basically three parts to it. Let me show you a neuron someplace. Here's a good picture. And I think the next picture is even better. Here is a neuron, at least one kind of neuron. The neuron is in this gold color, and it has some support cells around it in the gray color right here. These short little cells are support cells. These aren't neurons, but this big one that have all of these projections or processes sticking out of it, that's the neuron. The major part of the neuron, which contains the nucleus, and it contains a bunch of rough endoplasmic reticulum for making, what does rough ER make? Proteins, they have protein synthesis, and it's got mitochondria, a lot of different organelles. This is what we call the cell body. So think of your body, and then these things would be like arms and legs sticking off of it. So here is the cell body. Another name for cell body is soma. All right, so here is the soma or cell body. Do we have soma on this slide? We don't, but you could draw it in. Right after cell body, just say soma, same thing. And coming off the soma, I see many of these short projections that are highly branched. These are what we call dendrites. Dendrites are the receiving part of a neuron. Right? They receive signals. It says right here, dendrite receptive region. They receive signals. These signals then travel through a dendrite over the cell body down into this very long process coming off of the cell body. And this is what we call an axon. So an axon takes information from the cell body and transmits it a very long distance down to these axon terminals. And many neurons inside your body, if we were to draw this to scale, if this was the size of the cell body, we would have to draw the axon way past the library. These are really, really long. So they could go from your spinal cord all the way down to the tip of your big toe. Right? So the dendrites are microscopic. The cell bodies are microscopic, but the axon is what? Macroscopically long. They could be a meter and a half long. As a matter of fact, maybe if we drew it to scale, it wouldn't even fit on campus, right? If we kept the cell body just this size right here. And information flows according to the direction of this arrow right here. And what can you tell me about this arrow? How many ends does it have? How many pointy ends does it have? One or two? Is it unidirectional? Is it one way or bidirectional? It's unidirectional. Information goes in one direction, right? So information always flows from dendrite to cell body down an axon and never the reverse way. So a neuron can only be sensory or it can be motor, but it can't be both at the same time, right? Because motor and sensory information goes in opposite directions. And a neuron can only transmit information in one. This region right here, coming off the cell body, reminds me of something that I have in the garage that I use to put oil in my car. And you might have one of these in your kitchen. I actually have a couple of these in my kitchen too. It looks like a funnel, and indeed it is, because it's funneling information from all over these dendrites and cell body, and where is it funneling it into? The axon right here. So it takes information, funnels it into this axon right here, and that funnel is what we call the axon hillock. So it's an important functional part. These are the axon terminals, and we can see there are some branches down over here, some terminal branches at the end of an axon. And if you look really, really close, I really like this arrow, so I want to zoom in, but if you look really close in your book, you'll see that there's a swelling at the tip of each of these axon terminals right here because there's something special going on. It helps form a chemical synapse. We're going to talk about a chemical synapse next. All right, so this is a typical kind of neuron with dendrites, cell body, and an axon. This is a really good exam figure. And don't forget, this chapter will be on the next test. All right, this is the last material for the test that's coming up right after spring break. All right, so these kinds of cells that we see here in gold have the ability to conduct electrical impulses. Right, they live a very long time. Some of these might be around your whole lifetime even. Right, they don't reproduce themselves. And most do not divide. Right, so the ones that you have after development are pretty much the only ones you're going to have. So for instance, when you have a spinal cord injury and you break one of these things right here, maybe you break this axon, guess what happens to your spinal cord? It loses the function of whatever this neuron is doing for the rest of your life. And if it's a motor neuron, then you lose control over those skeletal muscles. Right, at least for what we know in medicine right now, we can't get these cells to regenerate. But of course, we're really interested in learning how to do that. They have a high metabolic rate, which means they need a lot of what kind of compound? They need a lot of energy. What's an energy molecule inside your body? ATP, adenosine triphosphate. And your brain can make a lot of adenosine triphosphate because these cells have a lot of what kind of organelles? Right here, what are these organelles? Not shown on this slide. I mean, they're illustrated, but they're not listed with a lead line. What are these organelles that make ATP? Yeah, mitochondria. And what do mitochondria need to make ATP? They need sugar, they need glucose, but they need something else. What else do they need? They need oxygen, which is the reason why we inhale all the time. Right, so that these mitochondria can make ATP. And so I just want to impress how important or what a high metabolic rate they have, which is what a characteristic, high metabolic rate. If we were to cut off blood supply to the brain, all these cells, all these neurons would be using up ATP, and they need to be awake and alive in order for you to maintain consciousness. When would you lose consciousness if blood supply to the brain was cut off and your brain doesn't get oxygen? How long can you remain conscious? Okay, maybe we talked about this before, but 3 seconds, on average 3 seconds, all right? Because these cells use up ATP so fast, in 3 seconds, they won't be able to do their job. And then they're eventually going to die if they don't have oxygen. When does your brain actually die after blood is cut off? You lose consciousness in 3 seconds, but you're not dead yet. How long do you have before your brain actually dies? 3 minutes, so just a matter of minutes. That's why it's so important that people know CPR, because what can you do for somebody whose heart is stopped and then blood is not circulating in your body because the heart is stopped, so blood is not going to the brain? What can you do to help that person? you can artificially pump their heart by doing chest compressions, and it helps deliver some blood to the brain. They're not going to maintain, they're not going to wake up. There's not enough ATP to maintain consciousness, but usually there's enough ATP that's being made to prevent death of those cells. Okay, there's just enough oxygen getting there. So that's how important ATP is, made by those mitochondria. All right, so these neurons receive stimuli and transmit action potentials or electrical activity. And so remember, it always goes dendrite to cell body to axon. And you can see those are all just unidirectional arrows right there. All right, there are different kinds of neurons that we have in our body. And I do want you to recognize them by their shape and know what their function is as well. All right, so I got to go back over here because we changed what these cells look like a little bit in the textbook. That's not it. Ah, here we see them. All right, so I see three different kinds of neurons. I see 1, 2, and 3, and I see them up over here. I see 1, 2, and 3. I see the cell body, I see the cell body, and I see the cell body. All right, and I see dendrites on all of them, so I see dendrites right here, I see dendrites here, and some dendrites right over here. All right, this one right here is what we call a multipolar neuron. Multipolar is where we have lots of dendrites coming directly off the cell body, and then just a single, one very long axon coming off the opposite end. So this is a multipolar neuron. This is important. This is an example of a motor neuron or an association neuron. So motor or association or interneuron inside the central nervous system is a multipolar neuron. So when your body's sending signals out to skeletal muscle for them to contract, this is the kind of neuron that becomes stimulated. All right, the bipolar, named because there are two major projections coming off, not a lot of little dendrites, right, directly from the cell body, on opposite sides of the cell body, hence bipolar. Sometimes in some textbooks you might call this pseudo-unipolar. No, this is always going to be a bipolar, okay, because it comes off the cell body in two different locations on the cell. All right, but which way do signals go? From left to right or from right to left on a bipolar neuron? It's always going to be dendrite, cell body, down this axon. These kinds of cells right here are what we find in receptors for special sensation, like in the eyes and hearing. So these are special afferent or special neurons, special sensation neurons. Okay, but never motor. And then the last kind, what we call unipolar, because here's the cell body, and there's just a single process. The cell body has no dendrites. It has a single process coming off, and then that single process bifurcates into two divisions almost immediately. And one of the divisions here goes out to the periphery, and the other division goes into the central nervous system. So the part that goes into the central nervous system is called what kind of process? The part that goes into the brain or spinal cord is called the central process because it's going into the central nervous system. This part that goes out to the periphery is called the peripheral, right? And so these are the receptive endings or dendrites right here. Signals always go dendrite, cell body, okay, down the axon to this axon terminus. All right, so this is another example of a sensory neuron, but this one can be used for all kinds of sensation, not just special senses like vision and taste and smell. So if you take your fingertip and touch something, this is the shape of the neuron that's being used to transmit information from the periphery into your central nervous system for your perception. Okay, and this right here, the multipolar neuron, is the one that's being used like to contract the biceps muscle. It has to have this shape right here, multipolar. All right, so those are the three kinds of neurons by their shape, but you should also know what their general function is as well. I think I have that on the slide. All right, a second type of neuron is what we call a supporting cell. And sometimes we call that a neuroglia or neural glial cell. And we have some pictures of neuroglia cells way up over here. So I thought it was way up over here. Neuroglia cells, right here. Here's one kind of neuroglia cell. These are in the central nervous system. Let me go back just a second. Okay, and neuroglia cells will be categorized as to whether they're found in the central nervous system or peripheral nervous system. Let's talk about the central nervous system first. This one right here kind of looks like a star with a bunch of rays, sun rays coming out of it, right? And so it was named an astrocyte because of all these processes that are kind of poking out in all different kinds of directions, right? And notice that the color is what kind of green? Is it green? Pink. Gray. Okay, gray. Well, you're seeing exactly the way I see it. Gray. Okay, and then here is that gold cell. What is that gold cell? That is a neuron. So here is a neuron that sends electrical information. Here is the support cell. That's gray. It doesn't send electrical information, but it helps this cell right here do its job. All right. The other thing I see on this slide is this red tube. This is a blood vessel, and in particular, a capillary blood vessel. So things can leave the blood through a capillary, but not through an artery or a vein. And we see that this astrocyte is connected to a capillary with this one process. It's wrapping around a capillary. And then we can see with another little bridge right here, it's connected to this neuron. So an astrocyte can act as a special delivery system, taking things directly from the blood and transporting it and giving it to this neuron so it can do its job. One of the things that has a direct delivery right here is glucose, which is an important metabolite for this neuron to make ATP. All right, so it acts as a delivery system. The other thing that this astrocyte does is that they completely surround the capillary so that not everything that's in the blood can leak out into the brain. There are many toxic things that we have in our body, especially after a meal, that if it was able to leave the capillary, it could poison this neuron, and then what would happen to you if this neuron gets damaged or poisoned or intoxicated? What would happen to you? Well, your consciousness would be disturbed, or maybe the brain could even die as a result of that. So the astrocyte right here forms something what we call a blood-brain barrier. It forms a barrier around the blood supply to the brain so that only helpful substances can reach this neuron right here, right, to maintain the health of the neuron. And it keeps harmful, or at least most harmful, compounds in the blood so that they can't enter the brain, even though they're in the blood. So astrocytes help make a blood-brain barrier. Another thing that this astrocyte does is that it can teach this neuron right here where to build dendrites and where to build axons during development. And maybe this neuron right here is a multipolar neuron that you will have for the rest of your life. Nonetheless, this astrocyte can tell it to grow new dendrites, to make new connections in your brain. So astrocytes are very important in terms of long-term memory and learning, because it can actually, right, when you learn stuff, the shape of your brain actually changes, the shape of these cells actually change, right? And when the shape of your brain and these cells change, that changes the function of your brain. And that's involved with the learning process. So astrocytes are important for learning. Like, for instance, learning to turn your cell phones off. Mine is off. Guess what? Mine is not off, but I better turn it off. I forgot to turn it off when I went to hear a symphony play one time. And I sat right above the symphony, okay? And fortunately, I had it in silent mode, thank God. Otherwise, I would have been crucified probably. Okay, so during lecture, always turn your cell phones off in class. All right, so astrocytes are pretty important. It forms a blood-brain barrier. It tells where these neurons should connect up with each other, and it also delivers nutrients to this neuron so that it can be healthy. This is an astrocyte. Another kind of neuroglia cell that we have in the central nervous system, so we're still talking about the central nervous system, is this one right here. This is called a microglia cell, and it has a bunch of processes on it, and these almost look like dendrites. This thing right here can actually crawl around inside your brain and is looking for cells that should not be inside your brain, like maybe bacteria or fungi or viruses. And when it bumps into those cells, then it's going to cause the destruction of that cell and protect your brain from infection. But this microglia cell can also bump into tumors, maybe brain tumors. And if it can recognize that as a tumor, then it's going to destroy the tumor before it has an effect on you. So this is a pretty important cell. It helps protect the health of the brain. Right? And because it has all these dendrites, I think you ran into a cell that performs a similar kind of function in the epidermis. And it's called a Langerhans cell, and a Langerhans cell has another name to it. It crawls around inside the epidermis, helps fighting infection. It was called a dendritic cell because it has all of these things that actually look like dendrites on it that helps fight infection in the epidermis. But this one is in the brain. We don't call it a dendritic cell, though you probably could. We call it a microglial cell. All right, so we got some immune cells. If we go back one, here is an astrocyte that makes a blood-brain barrier. And we got a couple more. Inside our brains, there are cavities that are filled with fluid. We call those ventricles. And here is the brain on the diagram. Here is one of those cavities inside the brain that's filled with fluid, and there's a lining between the ventricle and the brain tissue. These are what we call ependymal cells. And they secrete fluid into the ventricles. They also help regulate ion concentrations in the brain and in the fluid that fills up the brain. All right, so lining the cavities inside the brain. When we get the central nervous system next week, we'll learn the names of those different cavities inside the brain. Right, and then here's another really important one. This is called an oligodendrocyte. Now, where are we talking about? Inside the central nervous system or in the peripheral nervous system? So far, all of these different cells. Yeah, we're in the central nervous system. So here is a cell inside the central nervous system. Here's the cell body. Here's a process. And then here is an extension of that process, and you see it wrapping around. What's it wrapping around right here? That's a part of a neuron, and in particular an axon, right? So it's that nice gold color. So this is what's sending electrical signals, and we see this wrapping around the axon. This is an oligodendrocyte, secretes insulation around the axon so that the electrical signal can't leak out. And if it can't leak out, it can be transmitted down the axon much more efficiently when that happens. So an oligodendrocyte wraps insulation around an axon, improves the conduction through the nervous system. That insulation is a compound that we call myelin. And so this wrapping around an axon is called a myelin sheath. So myelin is like a lipid, right, and it surrounds axons in the central nervous system and makes the central nervous system work a lot better. Every once in a while, sometimes a person's own immune system will recognize an oligodendrocyte as being a foreign cell, foreign to your body. Then what is that a person's immune system going to do? It's going to attack it and kill these cells. The myelin sheath is going to degrade and form a plaque inside the brain, and then the conduction of signals in that person's brain is going to be greatly disturbed as a result of that, and it produces a condition called multiple sclerosis. Right? And because when these oligodendrocytes die, it forms a plaque or a sclerosis, and that disturbs the conduction through these particular axons. And somebody that has multiple sclerosis, sometimes they're in a very active form of the disease, sometimes they're in remission. Right? So sometimes these cells are attacked, sometimes they're not, and it's just the job of medicine to extend the period of time of remission and to reduce the time that somebody's in an active form of multiple sclerosis, right? But it has to do with these cells right here, oligodendrocytes. All right, so those are the four kinds of cells that we find in the central nervous system that are support cells. They are astrocytes, number one, microglia cells, number two. All right, next one was the ependymal cells that line cavities inside the brain, and then the cells that insulate axons in the central nervous system. These are called oligodendrocytes. The other thing I didn't mention is that this one oligodendrocyte not just myelinates one axon, but how many in this diagram? We see three. It can myelinate multiple axons from different cells, and it can even lay down multiple layers of myelin sheaths either in front of or after this particular layer right here. So there could be another layer in front. There could even be another layer all coming from the same oligodendrocyte. So these are all found in the central nervous system. All right, we find some support cells in the peripheral nervous system and only in the peripheral nervous system. Sometimes their function is similar. Here I see a cell wrapping itself around an axon in the peripheral nervous system, but it is only at this one location. It won't wrap itself around another axon or at a different location on that same axon. This is what we call a Schwann cell. So a Schwann cell is in the peripheral nervous system. What's an analog to a Schwann cell in the central nervous system called? That's the oligodendrocyte, right? Same kind of function. And here is a gap between Schwann cells. There are gaps between oligodendrocytes in the central nervous system. We call these nodes of Ranvier. And the reason why these are really handy, because when you have a fiber, like this axon that's myelinated, the electrical signal doesn't flow from one molecule to the next, to the next, to the next, to the next. It actually hops down an axon from one node of Ranvier to the other, to the other. And when you're hopping, guess which would be faster? Okay, let's think of coming down the stairs. Say you're at the top of the stairs over here, and we're going to have two people. One over here, when they're going to run down the stairs, has to step on every single stair, or they're disqualified. But the person over here could step on every third stair. Which one is going to go down the stairway faster? The one that can skip stairs, right? So if an axon can transmit an electrical signal by skipping, it's much faster, right? We call that saltatory conduction. If it's not myelinated, the electrical signal has to move down molecule by molecule a lot slower. We call that continuous conduction when that happens. So for you personally, what would you rather have? Fast conducting neurons or slow conducting neurons? And let me just say, you're standing on a curb. You're ready to cross Lincoln Boulevard, and you step out on the curb, and then you look down the street, and like 20 feet away from you is a bus coming right at you. You want a fast neuron or a slow neuron? You want those fast neurons taking that information from your eyes to your brain, and then your brain realizing what's going on and then sending signals immediately back out to skeletal muscle so that you can get out of the way of that bus, right? So there's an evolutionary advantage to have fast conducting neurons compared to slow conducting neurons, right? And what makes a neuron fast is this myelin sheath around these axons. All right, so Schwann cells we find in the peripheral nervous system. And the last cell we find in the peripheral nervous system surrounds the cell body of this unipolar neuron, and we just call these satellite cells because they're surrounding the nucleus right here. Okay, these are just satellite cells, so they maintain the health of this sensory neuron. And these, both of these, satellite cells and Schwann cells, we find in the peripheral nervous system. Okay, so next time we're going to start by talking about the synapse. Okay, synapse. So what's today? Wednesday. All right, so next week we got to finish this chapter and move into central nervous system. All right, so sign-in sheet is going around. Make sure you sign the sign-in sheet.